The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each incidence of a police officer discharging a firearm has its own circumstances and complications. But among the most troubling involve fake weapons, imitation or toy guns brandished in standoffs with law enforcement. In the past 2 years, police have killed 86 people wielding guns that look threateningly real. A tragedy brought to light when 12-year-old Tamir Rice was fatally shot by Cleveland police in 2014 while playing with a BB gun in a park. John Sullivan is one of a team of Washington Post reporters and some of his students who've been tracking and investigating police shootings and fatal fake gun incidents. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So the toll, 43 people killed with fake guns so far in 2016, 43 also in 2015. There is on your article a gallery of these weapons. They look uncannily real. Are police trained to discern fake guns from real ones?
Well, that's part of the problem. I mean, it's very difficult, police say, to train police officers to identify these weapons that are virtually indistinguishable from their lethal counterparts. So if you're in a scenario where it's at night and somebody pulls out something that looks remotely like a weapon, police are trained to respond to that. And so police say there's really no way that they can train their officers to deal with these. But I should point out that, you know, police officers take real guns away from people every day on the street. So they are trained to deal with weapons and people who carry weapons. And much of the way they approach this is similar.
There are so many stories here. Can you just tell us about a couple of them?
You know, the oldest person killed was a person named Robert Patrick Quinn. He's 77, was 77 at the time, and he was fatally shot in Pittston, Pennsylvania, as he rode in his motorized scooter outside an apartment complex, waving a realistic-looking pellet gun. His family said at the time that he was distraught. He was dealing with a lot of pain. Another case was that of Ernesto Flores, a mentally distraught 52-year-old man who, after a standoff with police in 2015, stepped out of his house in California holding a BB gun, and police shot and killed him in front of his family and neighbors. And probably the most tragic case was that of Tyree King. Tyree King was killed in Columbus, Ohio this year after he was with a group of boys who robbed somebody on the street. The boys ran away. One of them handed the gun to Tyree, who's 13 years old. He put it in his pants, and he was confronted in an alley by a police officer. He ran, and police shot him.
The Washington Post spoke to someone in the trade who said that demand for these very realistic-looking guns is actually going up.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious from just looking at the advertising that these are the kinds of guns that consumers are demanding. If you look at the industry itself, it's experienced a decline. You know, from the 1940s to the 1980s, you saw lots of replica weapons, toy guns. They were in stores across America. In the 1980s, parents started to think twice about buying these kinds of guns for their children, and especially as the age of people involved in real shootings went down. Younger and younger people arrested or shot in real shootings. The kind of toy gun market began to evaporate. And so now what we're seeing primarily is we don't see a lot of toy weapons, outright toy weapons, but we do see BB guns, pellet guns that are highly realistic.
I'm thinking, though, if there's a toy or a crib or something that kids use that could harm children, they get recalled or remade. Have there been any calls for recalling or changing the look of fake guns, either from the industry or from lawmakers?
Oh, yeah, there's been a lot of states, 12 states, that have tried to limit these weapons. There's the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico have also tried to limit access to these weapons. if you were to go online and try to buy one of these BB guns or pellet guns, and you're from the District of Columbia, they won't ship it to you. In L.A., they won't ship it to you. So there's been an effort to try to limit access to them, and there's also been laws like in Boston and Baltimore and other places where if you're caught with one of these realistic-looking weapons in public, police can charge you with carrying a real gun. So there is some effort, but you know, we're talking about quite a big marketplace, people all across America. There's lots of places where they're unregulated. In Ohio, there are no regulations, and Ohio happens to be an open carry state for real firearms. So it's, you know, if you're carrying one of these things in Ohio, police could assume that you're carrying a real weapon because they do see that.
John Sullivan is with us. He's from the Washington Post, and he's been tracking and investigating police shootings involving fake guns. Well, Congress has picked this up in the past, and this is something I wasn't aware of until I read your article. It's actually the NRA that is against any kind of regulation on even fake guns. Why are they involved?
Well, the NRA and other gun groups have tried to get their constituents to try to object to these bills across America. They did it in Maryland. They've done it in other places. I think they feel like this is, and they would not talk to us for the story, so this is just basically from reading their material and from talking to gun rights groups that did talk to us. I mean, they feel that this is kind of a war against guns in America and that there's no real reason to regulate these weapons, that they're not real, that they're not fatal types of weapons, and that this is kind of the media's crusade against guns, the liberal America's crusade against guns. And so I think they see this as somewhat of a slippery slope. You start to regulate these things. And also I think, you know, they see this as it's kind of a war against American gun culture. And so, you know, a big part of America in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s was indoctrinating your children into this idea of owning and handling guns in a proper manner. And so if you eliminate the kind of learning tools, or if you make them less realistic, or if you make them somehow apart from real weapons, you're going to disrupt that kind of process, this kind of training and indoctrination into a big part of American culture, which is learning to handle these things properly.
I can only imagine what a police officer must think or feel when they find out that the person that they shot was not actually threatening their lives, but aiming a toy gun at them. What did you find out about how police felt about these replica weapons?
Well, the case that we looked at where we were able to talk to police about how they felt, and we didn't actually talk directly to the officers. Most of the time, officers are not allowed to talk until an investigation is concluded, and most of the time they don't want to talk. In talking to the analysts that talk to police officers and talking to the chief in this department in Alachua County, Florida, who killed a 16-year-old boy who was carrying an M16. It was an airsoft rifle. It looked exactly like an AR-15. It's the exact weapon they were carrying that night. It's the exact weapon they killed him with. And so they encountered this man, a 16-year-old boy, who was distraught in a parking lot. And after they shot and killed him, the officers went to the weapon that had broken in half and put it on the trunk of one of the police cars and noted that the weapon seemed very light, that it was probably not real. And I think that's when the realization started to hit these officers. The next day when they all found out, they were devastated. And the psychoanalyst who talked to them said that they all grieve the loss in really vivid terms. I mean, and even though they felt like they had no choice, you know, anytime you take a life, I think it's devastating, and that's something that we don't talk a lot about, is how officers deal with that.
Your reporting generated a lot of comments, many people advocating for fake guns to be painted in bright colors or otherwise identified. Others saying, oh, well, this is natural selection at work, you know. We are on the internet after all. But another said 43 people a year. You know, how many get killed falling off bicycles or skateboards or hit in the head with a baseball? Is this much ado about nothing?
Well, I think any time you encounter, you know, somebody gets shot and killed in a what appears to be a preventable circumstance, people are going to, you know, want to see some kind of examination of how we might do better. And I think you see the same thing when you're dealing with people who are mentally ill, who are confronting police officers. You know, is there a way that we can respond better to recognize what's really going on here rather than just responding to this threat? And I think, you know, officers, when they're going into these circumstances, they're armed with information that comes from a dispatcher, that comes from a witness who might not be professionally trained in how to determine the threat level. And so it does a couple of things. It places the officers in a very bad position. They're forced to deal with somebody. It's very difficult to identify whether the gun is real or not. So they're put in a situation where they have to kill somebody. And the person is obviously, you know, the loss of life is huge and affects a lot of people. So, I mean, I think while it's a small number, 43 a year, I think what makes this important is that it's these shootings are particularly tragic. I mean, you're talking about 12 and 13-year-old kids getting shot and killed by police, and that takes a big toll on a community, a big toll on the officers, a big toll on society.
John Sullivan from The Washington Post. He is one of those who has been tracking and investigating fake gun incidents and tracking all police shootings. His article was produced in partnership with the Investigative Reporting Workshop at American University, where several of his students contributed. John, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a link to read the article and see a gallery of the imitation weapons involved, and take a look at the Fatal Force tracking data. All of that is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 10 years ago, the demographics of New Hampshire and of Concord High School were almost identical, both 93% white. While that number has remained steady for the state, the capital city's high school has diversified in a big way. Today, more than 10% of the school's 1,600 students are or were refugees resettled from some 66 countries. Many are of color, the very populations that have been targeted by a spike in hate crime since the election of Donald Trump. Senior Renee Dutier is among the international students taking part in an initiative aimed at changing the way that they are seen and understood by their predominantly white peers. Word of Mouth's Jimmy Gutierrez went back to school to find out how it's working.
There's a new lesson plan at Concord High, and it couldn't have come at a better time.
Pretend it's not a microphone. It's talking. You do that so well. Do you want me to stand behind you?
I do, but I'll tell a microphone.
That's Anna Marie Di Pasquale. The kids call her Miss D, and Renee Dutier, a senior at the school. We're heading to a classroom as part of Ms. D's newest project, Travel Around the World. The idea is simple. Ex-refugee students share their cultures and traditions firsthand.
What do you have prepared?
I'm going to talk about my lovely country and tell them about my culture, the school, the weather.
Presentations I checked included a tasting of carrot halwa, a surprisingly sweet Pakistani dessert, the story of struggle behind the Burundi flag. I even learned how to say, how are you?
Boni.
And I'm fine in Lingala.
Malamu. No, malamu. No, malamu.
Malamu.
Yeah.
I'll be the first to say that language can be tricky, something that Renee has had to master throughout her childhood. Born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, her parents fled war to Rwanda when she was 8. For the next 4 years, Rwanda was home. Then her house was intentionally set on fire with some family still inside. Neighbors helped everyone escape, but her parents were badly burned. After that, they moved to Uganda, and in 2012, they were resettled in Concord, New Hampshire. Renee, now 14, was fluent in trauma and 3 languages. Today, in her 4th language, she casually stands in front of 20 students talking all about Rwanda. She tells classmates how some of the schoolgirls have to shave their heads. She shares music and talks about the ultimate equalizer, food.
We have to buy a fresh chicken, like actually a fresh one that is the real chicken. So you have to kill it.
I always like this.
You have to kill it and cook it.
I can't even kill like bugs and stuff.
Renee is an expert in everything that relates to her culture. We have so many students that are experts in their own experience, so why not share all that expertise in the classroom? And then it benefits the whole school.
Miss D has an over-caffeinated vibe that comes to life in her eyes. She says her role working with the refugee kids is to give voice to their needs. It's something she's been addressing since she started 6 years ago.
First couple months I was here, I went into the social studies classrooms and we talked about how do we move beyond stereotypes. We get to know each other. We share each other's stories.
That's the motivation for Be the Change, a student-led social club which brings refugee students and American students together to learn from each other. The club also speaks to Concord's transformation over the last 20 years as a resettlement site. In 1995, Concord schools were 97% white. Today, almost 20% of the district's students are non-white. While taking in refugees has always been contentious, a new tone was struck this past election season. Here's President-elect Trump at a rally last year in Keene, New Hampshire.
I'm putting the people on notice that are coming here from Syria as part of this mass migration, that if I win, they're going back. They're going back. I'm telling you, they're going back.
In the 10 days following Trump's election, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported close to 900 hate crimes, most coming in K-12 schools, colleges, and universities. With calls for closed borders and whispers of a Muslim registry, there are some students in the majority speaking up.
Instead of just seeing, like, Sana, one of our Muslim students wearing her hijab and just making assumptions, when you actually learn about her culture and her religion, it's actually a lot different than how, you know, the media and, like, politics make it out to be.
That's Juliet Greenwood, a senior at the high school. Growing up in Concord, Juliet says she wasn't exposed to much diversity. As a seventh grader, she was invited to one of Miss D's multicultural events and for the first time found herself in the minority.
Nobody spoke any English, but I was trying really hard to entertain people, and that's when Miss D said that I would be a great social worker, and that was our first kind of interaction.
A few years later, as a sophomore, she experienced something in her lunchroom that took diversity from interesting to important.
I mean, it's noticeable in the cafeteria. The white students sit at tables, and then the Nepali students sit at tables, then the more African students sit at tables, and there were some pretty derogatory comments from my friend group, and I kind of separated myself.
Juliet says she confronted her friends and their language. Now she's one of the leaders of the Be the Change Club.
But I find my role is really helping the white community, the enormous white community at this school, use me as an example. And to get the different, like, international students to see me as, like, an accepting white student and not one of the many that maybe aren't as accepting.
It was a matter of minutes before I ran into some of those not as accepting kids. In an empty hallway, a group of white boys at an open locker whistled and made monkey noises at Ms. D's Afro-Caribbean American intern, Kaylin, and myself. Kaylin didn't flinch. Later during the presentations, in front of multiple teachers and a reporter, a couple of fresh-faced white teen boys in polo hats mocked the club and their students standing only feet away. I asked Ms. D if this was the norm.
So I will say that for the most part, Concord High School is a super welcoming place. Today's an anomaly. You know, today was an anomaly. And it was, today was just an anomaly. I think that's, education is the answer to everything.
Combating racism isn't the toughest thing Renee's ever faced. But when international students first arrive, struggle is common.
I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to turn to. I didn't know nobody, matter of fact. I used to go home and feel so bad. I'll tell my parents, I'm like, I'm not going back to school. But they're like, well, you got to. Remember, back home, you didn't go to school. You got to go to school. You got to push yourself. So I kept pushing myself, and hey, look at me now.
There's a lot of tears in my office. I need to give them a space to make sure that they know that they're going to be okay. They will get the language, that people are going to love them and welcome them here. And this is their school.
While learning the language is a crucial point of entry, Ms. D tells me that there's also language that needs to be unlearned.
Because when I first arrived, same thing, that term refugee, language is powerful, right? And I was like, what? You're not refugees anymore.
When you call some people, yes, it would be kind of like not cool to be called like that. But otherwise, hey, we are used to it. We like heard it over and over again. It's like a song in our ears.
Ms. D's current tour through the school has served almost as a PSA, that the students from 66 different countries speaking 44 different languages are no longer refugees. This is their home. They're new Americans. It's also allowed her to indulge her own interests.
I love to travel. I love food. I love to learn new things.
I think we just figured out where travel around the world came from. You just wanted to travel cheap.
That's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. I don't have to deal with the jet lag. I get the same food. It's exactly right.
That's amazing.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Jimmy Gutierrez.
And we've posted a link to Anne-Marie's Be the Change Club at Concord High. It's at wordofmouthradio.org, along with some instructions for reporting hate crimes that was put together by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Again, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Movie scores and soundtracks set a film's tone, the mood, the energy. Often, the score is a kind of warning. That is, of course, John Williams' theme to Jaws, a movie directed by Steven Spielberg. 2 years later, Spielberg used a similarly bass-heavy track to clue the audience about another scary unknown, an alien life form in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Like most of popular culture, film scores go through trends, phases in which every movie sounds similar. Not something moviegoers can quite put their finger on, but once it is pointed out, it is everywhere.
It's called Inception. Already.
That noise, by the way, is called Brahm. Adrian Daub is professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University. He wrote about this particular and pervasive trend in movie soundtracks for long reads. Adrian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Okay, so how'd I do with my Brahm?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I must say, while I was writing the article, I never really said it out loud. And now that I'm discussing the piece, I'm really having to figure out how to vocalize that.
Let's hear it from the author.
Brahm.
I've always heard it or thought of it as the Inception sound. What is its origin?
It entered public consciousness and it entered seemingly every single movie trailer out there with Inception. But there are, of course, sort of earlier soundtracks that use sort of horn blasts. What sets, you know, Brahm apart is the sort of very synthetic, very sort of aggressive beginning of the sound that I think is sort of new.
Who produced it originally or created it?
Well, it was written or created for Inception by Hans Zimmer, the composer, but that's where there's already some disagreement. The sound appears to have been in the script, and Zimmer based it on a song that is actually played in the film itself. It's a song by Edith Piaf that the characters use, if you recall the movie, to jolt themselves sort of out of dreams. And it's fairly unclear exactly how much of the song, how much of that sound is sampled, and how much of that sound is simply created in studio.
All right, so you mentioned now it's on seemingly every trailer. Here is just a small portion of this sound from a montage of probably dozens of movie trailers.
Now, that's from a minute and 46 worth of Brahms. You know, that was just a small portion. It does feel like everywhere. It's everywhere once you notice it. Why is that?
Well, I mean, Hollywood goes through these phases and goes through these fashions, and trailer scoring in particular, of course, is not the place where people, you know, pay a lot of attention. I mean, as viewers, and so basically, it's maybe a little bit more susceptible to modish or faddish thinking. But I do also think it works really well with a particular kind of blockbuster filmmaking and trailer making that has become very dominant, right? The visual equivalent to the Brahm is basically the fade to black, right? The fact that instead of sort of the trailer telling you a coherent story, you get these amazing special effects shots where, you know, one giant thing slams into another giant thing, and then it sort of fades to black again. And this is, that's of course a style of trailer that rewards, you know, not using a big melodic hook, but instead, you know, something that is adaptable and portentous and kind of mysterious. And that's of course what Brahm is.
I spoke in the introduction about the theme from Jaws and how those bass notes are supposed to make us feel. So what clues is Brahm giving us about what we're watching on the screen?
I think that in some way, Brahm invades our privacy as movie viewers. There is a tendency with Brahm to use on-screen noise and use it in the soundtrack. And it turns out that the distinction between, you know, the soundtrack, music that is sort of there but no one on screen can hear, and on-screen sound, right, that everybody in the picture can hear, is kind of important to our feeling of filmgoers that A, this isn't fully real, and B, that there are certain rules to the fiction. And Brahm sort of shreds that. It's not the only sound that does that. If you listen to the soundtracks to some modern thrillers, for instance, the Jason Bourne movies, they do something similar with a sort of garbled electronic noise where you can't quite decide, is this actually something the composer put there, or is that the sound designer doing something with the scene? Is Jason Bourne physically hearing this sound, or am I?
You talk about this specifically in Jaws in your essay, that first scene on the ocean, the first attack. Why is the score and the sound design so important in that case with that scene?
Well, the sound designers and John Williams staged this really canny handoff. We start out with these sounds of the ocean, which are really sounds that if you were underwater, you'd hear. And then as the camera starts that very famous move where it sort of starts taking on Jaws' point of view, all that noise fades out in favor of the famous half-step theme. And the effect of that is essentially that we sort of get a very subtle signal saying you're leaving the ocean that you know and you're entering Jaws' ocean.
I'm speaking with Adrian Daub about the sound Brahm and how it invaded Hollywood and changed the way that we listen to movies. So do you think that registers for us on a conscious level that this is pretend, this is not pretend in the world of movies?
I think it must, yes. I think there is something, and I mean, all of us can sort of check this on ourselves. Brahm is unnerving, enervating, really quite upsetting sometimes, right? The Inception trailer, I think, was copied so much because it kind of freaked you out when you first heard it. And my guess, it's not about the pitch, it's not about the way the sound is produced, it is about the fact that it sort of violates certain conventions of how we've been taught that film sound should behave, right? Film sound is something that we think so little about, right? It's a sonic vocabulary that we as viewers are incredibly ignorant of in some ways, right? I mean, the fact that, I mean, just if you want to, you know, do a little experiment, listen to doors closing in a movie, and you realize it sounds nothing like any door you've ever heard, or the knives that make sounds in horror movies, right? But we've accepted that. Whereas if visually films were to stray from realism or from, you know, being, you know, fully mimetic in the same, to the same degree, we'd turn off the TV. We'd say this is no longer real.
But still, they work on our brain somehow. I mean, a successful film score is something we can hum. You know, anyone can on the street can hum Star Wars or sing a little bit from the Frozen song, right?
Right, but we can't hum Brahms, yeah.
Right, well, that's what is so funny, because filmmakers have kind of seized on this thing that everyone sounds a little bit ridiculous, even calling it Brahms, when they're describing it. But why do you think everyone's using it? Is it a lot more on the nose? Does it communicate a lot more than subtlety, for example, in a film?
Well, in the article, I sort of came to the conclusion that part of it has to do with a changing economy of prestige around films. These soundtracks are no longer made for the same mode of consumption that, you know, the John Williams ones were. We're less likely to buy these scores on CD or record. We are less likely to hear them in concert halls. We are far more likely to hear them as techno remixes in a club. We're far more likely to hear them used in advertising. And my sense is that that just changes the kind of soundtrack sound that ultimately gets rewarded in Hollywood, right? The kind of sound, the kind of theme that starts traveling.
Well, maybe 10 years ago, it was every trailer beginning with "In a World."
In a World. That was like 20 years ago. Yeah, that's right.
We became aware of it, and they don't use it anymore. Now that we're becoming aware of Brahm, is it on its way out?
I think it can't be that long lived, but I think there are subtler features of it to it that are going to endure. I think, for instance, the Mr. Hyde to the Dr. Jekyll of Brahms are these very simple motifs, sort of very minimalist motifs that are also all over, for instance, the Marvel blockbusters. And my sense is that stuff's going to stick around even once Brahms has sounded its last Brahms.
Adrian Daub, he's a professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
He's also author of 4 books on German thought and culture in the 19th century, as well as co-writing a book called The James Bond Songs, Pop Anthems of Late Capitalism. You'll find a link to read his essay for Long Reads, Brahms, the Sound That Invaded the Hollywood Soundtrack. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for The Bookshelf. NHPR's All Things Considered host Peter Biello's podcast features writers writing about and from the Granite State.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has spent her life writing about people and animals with curiosity and compassion. She studied people in Africa and imagined the lives of human beings who lived thousands of years ago. She's also investigated the hidden world of dogs in a book by that name. Now she's written a book that looks back on her life. It's called Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. She has done so much traveling in her 85 years on this planet, but the road has led her back to Peterborough, New Hampshire, where she lived as a child and where she served on the town's select board. We spoke about her new book at her kitchen table in Peterborough. Thank you so much for letting us into your home.
Thank you for coming.
You've been pretty much a lifelong Peterborough resident, correct?
Yes. My parents came here in 1935. And it's kind of been home to me ever since. But my husband and I have lived all over the place. We've lived in Nigeria for a while, and we lived in Virginia for a long time. We lived in Cambridge, Mass. But this was home.
And this, where we are now, is a family residence, right? Or at least a family plot of land?
It was what my dad got. He was the sort of person that doesn't want to see the smoke of his neighbor's chimney. So, in those days, the farms were being abandoned and sold very low price. He bought hundreds of acres, and there the whole area was then divided between me and my brother. Most of it is under conservation too, but it's essentially one family, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're here, of course, to talk about your new book, Dreaming of Lions. And I guess I should apologize, because in this book you said that you generally write from very early in the morning until very late at night. So we're interrupting your writing time today.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, very good reason for me.
Yeah, but is that true? So you normally write almost dawn to dusk?
Yeah, for some reason I get up at about 3. My dogs want to get up at 3, and there's not much choice. Dogs are there scratching you and barking, and so you have to get up, and I do. But it's a very good time to work, from 4 a.m. to 9, 5 hours there. The phone doesn't ring. You can't do anything else. You can't make your phone calls. You can't go anywhere or shop or anything. There's nothing to do except work, so it's very, very good, and very good for the concentration. It's quiet. It's perfect. I like that time very much.
Yeah. In this book, you write a lot about Africa, your time in Africa. And one of the things you said in the book was that sort of all of your writing has its roots in some way in your time in Africa. What is it about your experience there that makes it so such a foundation for your work?
Well, for various reasons, which I'll explain later if asked, we went into a 120,000 square mile area that was unexplored. We were certainly the first non-Bushman or non-San people who had ever been in there. And the people were pre-contact. And the way they lived and the way they solved their problems and what they valued and what they didn't value was our way of the human way of life for thousands and thousands of years, since we became human, really, since we came out of the trees, just about. That informs a lot. I mean, that's a big thing to know. And you see, I see everything else through the light of through that window.
One of the things that struck me about the people that you were writing about, a thing that you mentioned in this book, is that they were so good at, yeah, they had an eye on the future, but they were also very good at living in the moment and observing. Like, they could look outside and know so much about the soil and the trees around them. And that seems to be something that the average person here in this country nowadays has lost.
Oh, completely. We've lost it. We've lost it completely. First of all, they didn't look outside. They were outside. But if you live in the natural world, as they did, or as any life form does, any mammal or bird at least, you have to live in the moment. You have to pay attention to what's going around you all the time. Because at any moment, a predator can appear, or a opportunity of some kind can appear. So you look and listen. This is very real for them. Interestingly enough, it's a little bit like meditating. When you meditate, you open your mind and let it all in, so to speak. Well, that's what they do all day. They let it all in. And I think it gave them a mindset that's a little different from ours. It's different. I can't quite say how, but it feels they don't have these nervous anxiety fits, although there certainly would be no reason for them not to be anxious about things. I mean, in other words, the San were our ancestors, as you may know. And since we were also the rest of us were hunter-gatherers, they were much the same as we are much the same then as we are now. So in most ways, I'd say.
So what is the book you're writing now?
Well, it's about, I don't know what to call it. It was called The Unknown World, or also A Walk Through the Reaches of Time. I don't know if it'll be, I'm not there yet. And it's about life as it developed. Bacteria, protists. Nobody knows what a protist is, but they will when they read the book. Animals and fungi, which are related. They have a common ancestor, and plants, and how these things manage and what became what, that kind of thing. It's to give an idea of what's around us. Again, it's a hope of, if you're going to be inside, at least read about the outside. And it's fun to write. It's not finished, but that's one of the points that it makes, is that if an octave, my friend Simon Montgomery, she wrote the octopus, a book about an octopus,
The Soul of an Octopus,
doing very well and very, very well known. And who would have thought that an octopus could think, could recognize a person by looking at the person, and distinguish one individual from another, and act accordingly, and solve problems? And I mean, it's just a fabulous thing for people to know. And it's very good that this kind of information is getting around, because an octopus is related to an oyster or a clam, and a very different life form than us. But the important thing is that most life, even trees, has anybody seen the Hidden Life of Trees? Fabulous book about trees. And most life forms, certainly all the, does anybody know what a eukaryote is? No. These life forms are eukaryotes.
Not since biology class in high school.
And the paths they've taken are very much the same, and obviously it shows what works, and it explains why we are who we are, why we do what we know or have the abilities we have. And other creatures, including trees, have similar abilities, which they approach in slightly different ways, but the similarity of everything is what's so interesting. And that this book tries to address that subject.
Well, Elizabeth, I hope we get the chance to talk about that one when it comes out.
Oh, I hope we do.
Thank you very much
Thank
for speaking
you.
With me.
Thank you very much.
And that was the latest installment of The Bookshelf, with host Peter Biello speaking with author Elizabeth Marshall Thomas in her kitchen. Her most recent book is called Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. Peter is always looking for reading recommendations from our listeners, so if you do have suggestions, send him an email at books@nhpr.org. W-2s, 1099s, and other documents are being mailed out to American taxpayers this month. Meanwhile, in the UK, self-assessment forms must be filled out and taxes paid by January 31st or risk a £100 fine. Unless, of course, you have a good excuse. Ruth Owen of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs Office has already seen a few humdingers which did not sway her staff, including, "My tax return was on my yacht, which caught fire. A wasp in my car caused me to have an accident, and my tax return, which was inside, was destroyed." Several blamed children or partners or colleagues for inadvertently destroying their forms. And then there's this one. "My wife helps me with my tax return, but she had a headache for 10 days. Other petitioners chose to keep it simple, one saying, "The postman doesn't deliver to my house." So far, there have been no reports of blaming Brexit. Could it be that those worked? We, however, have a few months to come up with an excuse, or better yet, just get your paperwork together and file by Tuesday, April 18th. That's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for listening. Music in this episode came to us from Ketza, Ryan Little, La Venganza di Chitara, and Jazar. Loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can listen on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And please rate the podcast on iTunes. You know, everything goes further when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.